er mennesker, og mennesker er makt. Av og til kan en redaktør i bakgrunnen gjøre en forskjell i verden. Rebecca Corbett, redaktør med ansvar for undersøkende journalistikk i New York Times, var den som ledet New York Times sitt arbeid med å avsløre Harvey Weinstein, Hollywood-mogulen som i årevis hadde trakassert og forulempet kvinner. Skuespillere, stjerner og damer som var mindre prominente. Jeg var så heldig at jeg fikk intervjue Rebecca Corbett fra scenen under Nordiske Mediedager i Bergen denne våren. Nordiske Mediedager hadde klart å invitere henne hit, og det var en gave, synes jeg. Her kommer vår samtale. Vær så god.
Hello everyone. You've been leading more projects to Pulitzer Prize than I can name here and now. This last time for the Harvey Weinstein stories that led to the global Me Too campaign. Congratulations, first of all.
Thank you.
Let us start with the beginning. It was a goal for you as head of the investigative desk in New York Times to do more aggressive reporting on sexual harassment. Why?
Well, this was really a paper-wide commitment. The Times had been aware, of course, of allegations of harassment against prominent men for quite a while. There had been the Bill Cosby scandal just a few years before. There had been the Roger Ailes scandal, which forced his ouster at Fox News. In 2016, several reporters were dispatched to look into Bill O'Reilly. And what they found after many months was that he had this history of secret settlements for huge amounts of money with women who had made allegations of harassment against him. Shortly after the first O'Reilly story was broken by two reporters at the paper, Emily Steele and Mike Schmidt, we gathered a small group of editors and reporters across the paper, including several from our investigations department, discussed whether there were other prominent men and men in other fields, in other industries, who had similar histories of sexual harassment and misconduct that had been covered up. In that discussion, we talked about looking at different fields. Some names came up, and we also wanted to make very sure that we were not just looking at women in fairly privileged positions, but also at blue-collar workers and low-wage workers. In that meeting and a subsequent one, we decided to pursue a number of stories, but including Harvey Weinstein.
And actress Ashley Judd was the first to break the silence. What impact did her story have on the progress of your work?
Well, there was an endeavor by the reporters on the Weinstein story, Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey, for the five or so months of their reporting to try to get as many women on the record about their encounters with Weinstein. And they pursued actresses, they pursued office assistants, people who had worked in Weinstein's two companies over decades. Many women were reluctant to speak out because they were worried about career consequences. They felt a sense of shame about these encounters in which they were victimized. And a number of women were willing to do it if other women came forward. But it's sort of hard to organize a group of people to come forward simultaneously because you have to respect the privacy of each of them. Just a couple of days before publication, Ashley Judd, who is a very prominent A-list actress in the United States, told us that she would allow her name to be used.
Was that crucial?
Was it crucial? No, because we had plenty of other documented cases in that first story. We had a revealed Weinstein's history of secret settlements of more than eight, and we eventually later reported it was at least up to a dozen. But it definitely helped give it some loft. I mean, she was a very well-known name.
This is very complicated material. Most of the times, there are only two persons who know what actually happened, the woman and the man who harassed her. What did you do to verify the women's stories?
Well, again, what we discovered, and the reason that we had looked into Weinstein in the first place, was that we were aware that other news organizations over the years, like us, had heard rumors about Weinstein and possible misconduct, but they had never been able to turn them into publishable stories. The goal here was to try to report the stories as fully as possible using the tools of investigative journalism, which is not just anecdotes from people about their experiences with them, but using documents, using internal company emails, using legal settlements. And so it was bringing all those things together and trying to corroborate as best we could every story that we used about a woman's encounter with Weinstein, which meant finding people in real time who were aware of it, or people subsequent to the incident, but well before we started our reporting. And in many cases, we found that a woman had told either an agent or a friend or a spouse or several people. We knew that we found that at one of Hollywood's biggest talent agencies that at least eight agents had been told by actresses of, you know, very unsettling or worse hotel room encounters with Weinstein. So there were a lot of people that had an awareness that something had happened, and that's what we really focused on pursuing.
Could you have published the stories if you didn't have the legal documents, the internal memos, all the paperwork, basically?
I mean, again, if we had a certain number of women on the record and we could have corroborated, you know, their stories or parts of their stories, we may have been able to do that. But I think it's like, you know, any story, there's all these different components, and you hope to have as many pieces as you possibly can. But sometimes you have to be satisfied with less. But we really wanted to get away from the he said, she said narrative, because we wanted this story to be as bulletproof as possible. We fortunately, because of the depth of the reporting and what we were able to find, we were not in the position where we had to, you know, just decide what we would do if we could not have other documentary evidence.
So this could be about history, but then the internal memo from the former Weinstein employee Lauren O'Connor turned out to be gold. What she described was not historical events, but things that happened only 2 years ago. How important was that memo in hindsight?
Well, in some of our reporting, we found that the incidents that women described to us had happened decades ago. And we learned after the first story, in some subsequent reporting, that there were incidents that went back to the 1970s. And there was a fairly early settlement, either from the 70s or the 80s. And what we weren't entirely sure of for quite a while was how contemporary the allegations of misconduct were. And so that memo was very helpful in extending the timeline. And we also discovered that as recently as a month before we published that Weinstein allegedly had a hotel room encounter where he made advances on women a month before publication.
Let's talk about hush money, about how mind men get away with allegations about their own misconducts, and the role of National Enquirer in all this. Tell me what you learned.
So they're separate but related subjects. As with, you know, we have discovered with many men, just like O'Reilly, Bill O'Reilly had our initial story reported that there were six settlements totaling I think, $32 million. A huge amount of money. And he had, these were ironclad agreements. The women, not only were the women prohibited from ever speaking about them, so were their family members, so were their lawyers. In one case, a lawyer was barred from ever having another settlement with him, which meant that someone who knew about the history could never exploit it to protect another woman in the future. And we don't know for sure how many settlements that Weinstein eventually entered into. We were aware of up to 12. But they were useful in hiding these histories. They were intimidating to the women involved. They all came with non-disclosure agreements. And they're an effective tool to silence women. Lawyers for plaintiffs' lawyers for women will say they are justified because they are a recourse for women to be compensated for harm done to them, and that's a legitimate argument that women whose careers have been derailed, who have suffered harm, deserve to be reimbursed for that in a sense. But they do have the effect of just hiding these histories.
Burying them.
Yes.
And National Enquirer, that's a quite dirty story.
So the National Enquirer was in Weinstein's case, an ally in protecting his reputation and serving to expose rivalries or produce information that could be harmful to not only women who he was trying to counter any stories they might tell, but also, his business opponents. He was a very close friend of David Pecker, who is the head of American Media Incorporated, which owns the National Enquirer, and a number of other gossip magazines and organizations, news organizations. Harvey Weinstein was able to exploit his relationship with AMI to have some of their reporters dig up dirt on women that he feared would speak out.
Tell me about the bullying and intimidation from Weinstein and his team towards you and your team.
So Harvey Weinstein is an aggressive personality who over the years has been very determined to tell the narrative of his career, his success, and been very resolute about making sure he gets heard. And he, over the years, he was in the way that Bill O'Reilly was, the biggest cable news star and, a conservative icon, Harvey Weinstein cast himself as a lion of the left. He saw himself as someone who produced films that furthered the career of many, many actresses, that told literary stories that in which women had huge roles. He saw himself as figure that was allied with the Democratic Party. He was a big Democratic donor. He liked to think he was a friend of Bill and Hillary Clinton. He certainly appeared at campaign events and was a donor and hosted fundraisers. So he had this image that was very crucial to his success, to his Oscar campaigns, to the success of his films. So he also had a history of feeling he could pick up the phone and call the editor of many news organizations.
Did he ever call you directly?
He called, he certainly, he would firstly through intermediaries. When he learned that we were doing this reporting, a hired publicist for him, with whom the Times has often dealt, reached out to us and said that what were we doing? Harvey wanted to tell his side. And
you decided to never go off the record with him?
Yes.
Why?
Because he was the target of an investigation. He was a prominent person in a very serious investigation. We took the same stance with Bill O'Reilly.
In order to not tie you up, in a way.
Yes, because when you are not speaking on the record, people tell you things that you can't use or you can't attribute, and it puts you in a box.
And he threatened to sue you. Did that scare you?
It did not scare our lawyer. Which was the most important thing. We have a fantastic lawyer who is like one of the preeminent First Amendment lawyers, and he is a very tough guy. Our investigation department makes heavy use of him. And Harvey had this circle of paid protectors, including David Boyce, one of the most famous lawyers in America, who at various times was representing the Weinstein Company, was representing Mr. Weinstein personally. Sometimes he was paid, sometimes he was acting as a friend. It was all very confusing. He brought in Charles Harder, who was a lawyer who was best known for taking down Gawker, which some of you may remember got involved in this whole Hulk Hogan messy story. He had hired Lisa Bloom, who was the daughter of Gloria Allred, who is one of the most well-known plaintiff's lawyer for women's, you know, harassment and other abuses involving women, workplace issues. And then various publicists.
And also former employees who called the victims.
Yes.
At times.
Yes. But just before I get to that, so in terms of the threats to us, Charles Harder wrote several prior to publication letters warning if we did this, if we did that, if we didn't take into this account. These are these very long documents that he sent to our lawyers, and we did publish, and Harvey an hour or so after publication threatened to sue us in a conference call with me and the two reporters, and at the same time one of our office assistants came. He told, I can't remember, it was the New York Post or the Washington Post first that he was suing us. And as he was telling us on the phone, someone came and waved a piece of paper. They had just seen the story move over the wire. So we learned seconds before he had told someone else first.
And those former employees, what did they call you?
In the course of, while we were reporting the story and his various paid protectors were reaching out to us, to the executive editor, and every time they were told, you have to deal with the two reporters and their editor, that some of his current employees or former associates called other former employees that he worried might be speaking to us and warned them of their non-disclosure agreements, told them that, you know, they should protect Harvey and warned them not to talk to what he called cockroach journalists, which was a new label. So,
what about the complicity question? All those who turned away. This had been going on for decades. There was even a joke about Weinstein on the Oscar gala from stage in 2013. Right. How could this go on for so long with so many people knowing?
Well, I think the answer is one that has applied with many of the men who, across industries, across countries, have been accused of misconduct, that it turns out that they had often had clear patterns, that people knew something of it, that often women had said something to people, either bosses or people who they trusted and worked closely with, to people who did, in Weinstein's case, of people who did business with him. But they through a number of tools and because it was, many people found it not in their own interest to call out Weinstein. So there was the non-disclosures, there were the settlements. In many cases with the talent agencies, agents told women, this is just the way you have to do business with Harvey. I think that many people knew that Harvey approached women and made advances on women. In many cases, it seemed there was an assumption that these were consensual activities. In some cases, there was reason to suspect more. And inside his own company, the board, for the most part, was not informed of anything until just a year or so before the story broke, when there was an incident involving an Italian model. And she went to the police in New York. But that was effectively shut down. So there were, these various mechanisms that he was able to stifle his broad history. And it turned out, I think, to be shockingly pervasive. And even after publication, so many more women came forward.
The terrible guy getting the better job, that's not an unusual experience among women. Donald Trump is clearly an example of this. What role did the anger after the election of Donald Trump play in all this? Would there have been a Me Too if Hillary Clinton had won the presidency?
Well, it's interesting about Trump and how that played out. What we found in doing reporting, not just on Weinstein, but on a number of other men that we subsequently reported on, media figures, political figures, men in other industries, when speaking to women and reaching out and trying to persuade women to tell us their stories, some women said that the fact that during the campaign, when we and others reported about the Trump accusers, and they were, basically accused of making things up. And it did not cause that much of a stir. It certainly did not derail Trump winning the presidency. So a number of women said, why should I speak out? This information about, it was nearly a dozen women who spoke of some type of harassment that they claimed they had endured from Trump. And it had no effect. So they found it a dispiriting consequence, and it made them, in some cases, unwilling to speak out. Others said that it motivated them, that it frustrated them, that someone could rise to such a prominent position, have faced more than a dozen allegations of harassment, and it went nowhere. So they found it more motivating.
Me Too is also about history, men who did things in another time when it was all normal. Is it fair to measure misconducts from the past against today's moral rules and rules of conduct?
What's interesting was that so many of the men were older men of a, previous generation. But I think that there's pretty clear rules about right and wrong, and maybe, certain things that you might say that are, slightly off color or something might be more offensive I'm not sure I even believe this, but arguably more offensive now than maybe they were, you know, decades ago. But I don't think assaulting women or intimidating them or, you know, trying to extract a quid pro quo for career advancement was ever acceptable, nor should be.
I agree. I totally agree.
And I'd also like to point out that one of when the first Weinstein story ran, he put out several statements, and I believe that one of his statements was, there were so many, this is the price of having many paid protectors who all have different ideas about how to protect someone. But he talked about how this, he had learned that some of the things he had done earlier had been offensive and he had not intended that. And it was sort of described as this, you know, journey he had been on. But many of the men who have been accused of misconduct, both, you know, through Me Too, through journalist accounts, are not men of a previous generation. They're men at Silicon Valley startups. They're men at Vice. They're men in the entertainment industry of a range of ages. So I don't believe that it's a generational thing, nor do I believe that that is an acceptable excuse.
Mm. Some people say the campaign has gone too far. You could also turn it around and say that it's not gone far enough. Has it reached all parts of societies? Will low-wage women be affected, shopkeepers, industry workers, or has this been more of an upper-middle-class phenomena?
So I think that the prominence of media figures, of entertainment figures, has certainly led to a lot of the coverage and a lot of the debate. But in the, you know, just in the 3 months, if you look at all of the Times coverage last year, we looked at, you know, elite figures, but we also reported about food servers, students, Ford factory workers, and office assistants who were little-known people. Many of Weinstein's alleged victims were not well-known actresses. They were aspiring actresses who were 19 and 20 and 21 years old, who were not well-known figures. And he also exploited generations of his own employees. Again, most of them not well-known figures and not in prominent roles. But I think that some other news organizations have done some very fine work on low-wage workers. We just recently did another piece on waitresses. But I do think that there is much more room to explore blue-collar jobs in various industries, the hospitality industry and others that really rely on a lot of low-wage workers, many of them in some cases undocumented, which make them the women more unwilling and unable to speak out. There's certainly a perceived class difference so far, and I think in some other countries, again, the political class and media figures have gotten a lot of attention, but it is certainly one of our ambitions for this year to continue to look more broadly at the issue and how it affects the most vulnerable workers. In terms of has the Me Too movement go far, firstly, I'd like to distinguish between our journalism and the journalism of other news organizations around the world and the Me Too movement. They are separate things. One led to the other. And I think that the Me Too movement has had an incredible power of allowing women to come forward in what seems like a safe way, to do it in numbers and to realize that that in many cases there are multiple victims of various prominent people. But Me Too is also unvetted information, and the accounts I'm sure in many cases are absolutely true, but we would not write a story just based on what someone said on Me Too. We would always apply our standards of reporting, and one of them is fairness. So the question of whether Me Too's gone too far, in some cases, there were some there was some reporting about several men where it seemed like the incidents were not very severe, and there were not many episodes reported, and it was a few days later, it was off with the guy's head, and I myself wondered, really? Was that really the right call there? But what you don't know is what else the employer or institution knew, what else the man may or may not have acknowledged. So it's very hard to know. But in some cases, you know, there are complaints that, you know, the you know, there's been this rush to judgment, that men are, you know, being becoming victimized themselves without, you know, sort of a fair hearing. But on the other hand, I was recently on a panel with a woman who has done a lot of reporting about farm workers and janitors and low-wage jobs. And what she was hearing was women in those occupations said, nothing has happened. Mm. No one has addressed anything. No one has been investigated, and that it's very risky still for them to speak out. So I think that you know, it cuts both ways, this claim of a backlash.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about you. As a young woman, you changed your study from science to literature, and you said that being a journalist is like being a perpetual liberal arts student. Elaborate on that.
Well, you know, as an editor, over the years, I've been drawn into many subjects that I never expected I would be, nor would I have thought I would have an interest. And it's amazing how you can get interested in a broad variety of things. You know, I've done everything from, you know, conventional, you know, politics to crime and, you know, what seems like sociology. I've edited religion writers, and at the New York Times, I've done a lot of national security, worked with reporters who have done national security coverage. I edited the NSA warrantless wiretapping story in 2005. I mean, one of the joys of it is you get to learn about something new and fill your head, you know, in these crash, like, research endeavors with all this new information. And then as an editor, you get to move on to the next thing, a perhaps completely different subject, and empty your brain of everything you just learned and fill it with something else. I mean, in the last few months, in addition to the harassment story, I've edited stories about, you know, the Russian influence efforts with Facebook. I edited the Cambridge Analytica story a few months ago. I've edited stories about bots. I can't even remember what else.
And you are described by people who know you as a behind-the-scenes person, a person people don't necessarily know unless they are familiar with the inner hierarchy of the New York Times. But those who know your position, you are known as one of the best and most talented media figures in American press. And you are behind the scenes by choice. Why?
Well, as an editor, you live vicariously through others. And I think early in my career, just by accident, I was sort of derailed into being an editor. And I think that I have, for whatever reason, the demeanor to be an editor. And part of that is your job is to make your reporter's stories the best they possibly can be. I take enormous pride and pleasure in that. And I don't need a byline.
And your role is described as part editor, part journalist, part shrink. That is quite a balancing act. How do you do it? And which of those roles are the most demanding?
Definitely the shrink part. And in my, I came to the Times first working in our Washington bureau, and in my office, there was this red leather couch that I inherited from longtime famous columnist William Safire.
Oh, you do have a couch.
I do have a couch. And it's very long, and it is tufted. And a number of men who wanted to vent about various things would stretch out on it. Their coins would fall into the little holes in the tufting. And after they would leave, after, you know, some amount of time where, you know, they wanted to discuss this problem with this reporting or that problem, or, you know, how they were mad about something or other that I had to calm them down. You know, I would collect these quarters and put them in a jar from the sessions.
So that's your payment.
Yes. And, you know, sometimes as an editor, you have to address various malfeasance, and fortunately with me, it's all been very minor matters. But even some of the most demanding reporters that I've worked with over the years, I really love working with them.
And you are known to be very caring about details. The importance of accuracy, knowing that one factual mistake can blow it all. Do that keep you awake at night?
Oh, yes. I basically have a sleep disorder, which anyone who knows me is aware of. And but, you know, particularly when you're on a big project, very demanding story, I sort of have this, I guess, you know, an athlete would use this term, sort of in the zone, where I'm able to multitask, but my head is really just, the information is rolling around in it. And, you know, you're trying to figure out, like, exactly how this story will take shape and work with the reporter on, you know, the writing, the organization, but also just mindful of everything that you have to be careful about and triple check. And I also have a weird knack for remembering details that maybe someone learned early on in the reporting that were quite amazing to us at the time, and then so much more information has happened, but they were the sort of details that were the things you would tell someone if you wanted to describe, you know, we call it the elevator summary of a story, or, you know, you're at a dinner party, what you would have said to them about, and could you believe this? And often reporters forget those things they learned early on because it's been replaced by new information. And often, you know, at the end of the process, they'll say, but wait a minute, remember that thing you told me really early on? And it's often this very trenchant quote or this just really important detail that evoked, you know, the feeling of some episode, or just really crystallized a key point. And it's one of my weird little skills.
As an editor, you have trained generations of journalists about the need for perspective. Journalism is about more than being accurate. It's about seeing a big picture, about context. Anyone interested can Google The Wire, editor Gus Haynes, and context, and you can see Rebecca Corbett in the figure of the great editor Haynes in that series. The creator of The Wire used to work with you at the Baltimore Sun, and he has on several occasions talked about you as Gus Haynes' role model. Tell me about context.
Well, perspective is everything in journalism, and to me as an editor, the scariest thing about stories is what is not in them but should be, and that one of the obligations of an editor is to make sure that firstly you really understand the material, and then you really try to figure out if the reporter has the full context. Some of the worst journalism mistakes have occurred when someone adds 2 and 2 and gets 5. They come to the wrong conclusion, even though the facts in the story are correct, but they missed the big picture. And I think that, you know, it's one of the hardest things to imagine what should be in here, and that I mean, part of the way that you get at that is to make sure that you are as informed about the subject matter as possible. But part of it is just to probe the reporters, how they drew these conclusions, and to ask them, but did you think about this or what about that? And this comes up very regularly with David Simon, who, you know, is he's one of the two journalists that I have described as phenoms in my entire career. I mean, he arrived at the Baltimore Sun, where I worked for a long time as this, I don't know, 19 or 20-year-old stringer for his college campus. And, you know, he turned into this, he became this incredible talent. And he was a police reporter, but he didn't just do police reporting. What he did was sociology of a city that was devastated by crime and a chronic drug economy. And he wrote about it, you know, first for the Baltimore Sun, then in the Homicide TV series, and then eventually in The Wire, in this incredibly complex way. There was a character, and David and I are very good friends, and we had some battles as a reporter and editor, because he's very passionate, and but they ended up happily. So there was a character named after me, but he said that Gus Haynes was in very large part modeled after me and another longtime city editor.
So we have to wrap up. Just one final question. This is about stories. What's going to be the story about you? Rebecca Corbett was the one who, woman who...
Helped reporters write great stories, and hopes to continue to do it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. So.